Hello, I'm Goldie Sayers, Olympic medalist, and welcome back to the EIS Insider, the podcast from the English Institute of Sport that lifts the lid on the science behind peak performance. Now, when I was competing as an international javelin thrower, my training week might consist of sprinting, jumping, weight training, and of course, throwing. But in recent years, we've seen the rise of different forms of exercise. Yoga and Pilates might aid flexibility, whilst HIIT, high-intensity interval training, claims to provide the same fitness benefits as a run, but in half the time. So are these more traditional forms of getting fit now outdated? Is cardio officially dead? With me for the long haul in this episode, or perhaps just a short, sharp burst, depending on what the science tells us, of course, I'm delighted to be joined by the EIS's senior strength and conditioning coach, Mark Campbell. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, Goldie. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. So did you go for a long run this morning?
I didn't go for a long run. I might be going for a bit of a run, chasing my daughters around the block later on. But no, running's not a big part of my fitness at the moment.
Is that because you don't particularly enjoy it, or is that because you see a lot more benefits in other areas or other forms of training?
It's probably a bit of both, actually. Certainly my biggest thing is staying strong and making sure I can move really well. But certainly cardio is important, but I look for other modalities to do that now rather than running.
I hear you, Mark, I hear you. So strength and conditioning coach, what exactly falls under your remit at the EIS?
I suppose the way I'd sort of describe it is we're support discipline that will work alongside coaches in sports to understand what the physical requirements are for those athletes in the sport to perform at their best. And then obviously we support the coaches in underpinning the technical work they do within the sports, so the actual sporting performance, underpin that sporting performance with the physical characteristics that are going to hopefully enhance that performance. And it's not just about the performance on the field of play as well, it's about the performance in training, which for the majority of athletes, that's where the real performance gains come. Training consistently well over many, many years with high levels of skill led by a technical coach supported by people like ourselves within the EIS means that we can get those athletes to high levels of performance.
And how do you kind of fit in what you do around the technical work that the athletes are doing, maybe in team sports or in individual sports like mine? How do you kind of work with those sports to get the best out of the athletes at Olympic Games or championships or a big tournament?
It's really just about understanding from the coach, and it's a coach-driven program that's athlete-centered, obviously. And so understanding that we are support staff, so we have to understand the philosophy of the coach and the sport. We have to understand the culture of the sport. We have to understand sort of the competitive environment. And we do that by, and I think this is one thing the EIS does really well, is we immerse ourselves within the sport. So our practitioners are told, look, yes, you're an EIS employee, but to really work well within a sport, you have to immerse yourself in it, get to know the coaches, get to know the athletes, get to know everyone involved in the sport, so you can then really start to understand what you need to do in your area to support what they need to do. And then, you know, as you sort of asked there, like how do we work alongside what sometimes can be a very, very busy training schedule from a sporting point of view? Well, it's about, okay, understanding that element of their training as well. What are they physically gaining from their actual sporting training? Because obviously there's, you know, sport output, there's a physical cost to it, and there'll be a physical adaptation to it that comes with just the training itself. Then an S&C coach will do the job of trying to really understand, okay, what do I need to give them to support that environment, both from a training point of view and a competition point of view? And then it's about, again, just working together with a coach to fit that into a program optimally, and then just very good planning. It might be over a year, might be over 2 years, might be a whole quadrennial that they plan out to make sure that the training inputs to change your physical quality possibly can work in conjunction with the technical training to make sure it's effective.
So when you're talking there about, obviously, there's a lot of fitness that comes with playing the sports, especially, I would guess, in a team sport. And I know you've worked with a lot of rugby players and sevens players in particular. So how much cardio for, say, a sevens rugby player would they actually be doing outside of matches, perhaps, because presumably they're doing quite a bit of it in the game?
Actually, sevens is a great example that you bring up there, Goldie, because obviously sevens in the game, it's a very short, sharp game. And essentially what they're doing is high-intensity interval training for the whole period of the competition performance. And so, you know, like I suppose in relation to this chat, it's a brilliant example because they will need to do a lot of cardio to underpin various elements of that performance. And quite rightly, the training itself is going to be very, very intense because the skills that they utilize in the field of play have to be put under pressure. in a training environment. So the SSE coach will have to rationalize what other inputs they're putting in. It may not be beneficial to put more high intensity work in. It may be more important, like you say, to do more cardio work in the appropriate modality that doesn't necessarily put them at more injury risk. So they might not do a lot of more work running-wise because they already do such a high load of high-intensity running anyway within their sports training. So they might do, as you say, as you've said, cycling or might be rowing, might be various sorts of different types of metabolic circuits using resistance training. And there's a number of sort of very popular things in the general public at the moment that some of those SSE coaches might utilize modalities like, well, they probably won't use CrossFit itself, but modalities that are similar to that because it's very, very intense and it does support the physical requirements of the sport.
Metabolic circuits. What do you mean by that, Mark?
I suppose there's a number of different ways you can put them together, but say you might choose, say, 10 exercises. So it could be, say, a squat with a light barbell, lunges, burpees, it could even be press-ups and push-ups, things that you can do for a relatively high number of reps. You piece them together in a circuit, do them relatively continuously. You can do them for a period of time. You can do repetitions of them and have a short rest. And then you just literally just go for it. And you might do that sort of, you might do say 10 or 12 exercises. You might do that sort of continuously for 20 or 30 minutes. But obviously it's not just about the cardiovascular system. There's a huge muscular cost as well, which for a sport like sevens, there's a huge muscular cost involved because of the intensity of the work they're doing, not only in running, but also in obviously having a good wrestle and trying to tackle people as well. So it's understanding, you know, what are the physical requirements of the sport and making sure that the athletes can tolerate it. I mean, when I was working in rugby back in New Zealand, one of the coaches that I worked with, his philosophy was to make training harder than the game. Which is pretty brutal when it comes to preparing for a rugby game, which is very, very hard indeed. But his philosophy was, well, if I make my training harder, they won't find the game hard.
Do you believe in that philosophy? Would you say that was the right way to go? Or are you a bit more worried about injury risk as an SNC coach?
I certainly probably would be a little bit more cautious. But the thing is, if that's the key thing. And that's the thing I think SNC coaches and other sports staff do really well. If that's the philosophy of the coach, that's the philosophy of the coach. You have to then figure out how you can work into that system to support the athletes too. Obviously, probably one of your biggest issues with a philosophy like that is prevent injuries happening. So it means you're probably not going to make your training super, super hard. You're going to do the things that will support being able to deliver that training philosophy by the coach. And there may be times, and certainly there are times when I have trained athletes at Olympic level in different sports and I have absolutely gone to town on them. So working in GB boxing for a number of years, that's certainly a sport that has a requirement to be physically, have a huge amount of physical endurance under huge duress. When someone's chasing you around the ring trying to punch you, you probably need to be very, very physically able to prevent that person doing that or do it to them. So I've certainly put some very hard sessions in place, but only once I understand where we are with the training plan alongside the coaches.
And I guess throughout this podcast, we might touch on aerobic training and anaerobic training. Can you briefly just explain the difference between the two? I mean, I can hold my hands up and safely say I was definitely an anaerobic athlete, that's for sure. But I'll let you explain why.
Yes, you certainly were. I guess it just refers to the way the body produces and utilizes energy. If you're working for a longer period of time, and even if you're doing intervals, which can be more intense and you have short rest, it's predominantly going to be the aerobic system. If you're doing very, very short, intense bursts, so your performance is obviously Goldie, a fantastic example, extremely short bursts, but at the very, very extreme end of anaerobic, you'd probably categorize true anaerobic work probably up to about a maximum of 40 to 50 seconds. There's still a contribution of aerobic. It all mixes together, but the shorter the effort is and the more intense the effort is, the more likely you're going to rely on the anaerobic system. And there's other things that are involved in delivering those performances. So yeah, a 400 meter runner, you see them when they come across the line, 400 meter runners. They do not enjoy the feeling that comes from that. I've trained a few 400 meter runners. They say at about 300 meters, it feels like a giant bear's jumped on your back and you've still got to keep on running. And then obviously for yourself, that very, very short output, even 100 meter runners, you know, that's probably the very, very extreme end. But then obviously you go to the other end and you've got marathon runners. Although, you know, when you look at a sub 2 hour marathon, which has been run, the pace is ridiculous. And so for some people, even trying to run that pace for 100 meters would be quite challenging. But some people have the systems that can do it for a long period of time.
Yeah, no, certainly putting a treadmill on at 17, 18 K an hour or whatever they run at is quite a challenge in itself.
It is, yeah.
we've mentioned HIIT quite a few times. So just for those who perhaps don't do any high intensity interval training, what is it and what benefits do you get from it in the body and elsewhere?
Yeah, so as you've said, it's high intensity interval training, and it can come in many different forms. There's been a lot of research done as to the adaptations that will occur from a very, very short, intense exercise. And then obviously with a high intensity interval training means that you're actually trying to repeat those short, intense bursts. Essentially, the body's going to respond very strongly to that stimulus because it's such an intense, stressful stimulus. And the human body, one term I use, it's a very lazy organism. It does not like to be stressed. So what it does from a fitness point of view, if it gets a very intense stress on it, it will make adaptations to make sure that stress applied again isn't as demanding and isn't as stressful. So what high intensity training, interval training does is puts an incredibly high stress onto the body. So it's like, whoa, I did not like that. I need to make sure that I make some adaptations very quickly and very significantly to make sure that that stimulus isn't going to be as much of a problem for me next time. So compared to aerobic training, the stimulus is much more potent. So it's going to produce some very strong adaptations.
And why do you think it is grown in such popularity? Is it because people have got less time these days, or is it because it is such a good kind of way to burn fat? What is it, do you think?
I think the time thing is a big piece. Obviously, the modern world is incredibly busy, but people still recognise the need to stay fit and healthy, and it's one way of doing it. The burning fat thing is quite interesting, Goldie. So when you look at it, in a nutshell, with high intensity interval training, it's not so much about the calories that you burn during the session, because obviously it's quite short. For the session itself, you for a 60-minute run compared to a 10-minute high intensity interval training session, you would burn more calories overall in that session in a 60-minute run. But what happens afterwards is the key thing. Because you have raised your metabolism to such a high degree with the high intensity interval training, it's the increased metabolism post that session that remains very high for a long period of time. Now, like, that's a very simple understanding of it. Nutritionists and physiologists will be able to explain that much better than myself. It's called post-exercise oxygen consumption. Whereas if you do a 60-minute run, as soon as you finish that run, your metabolism is going to drop pretty much back to normal, and so the calorie burning ends. The other thing I think with high-intensity interval training, and obviously I think what's popularly known is like doing it on a bike or a treadmill or a rower or something like that, but you do the same thing with some resistance. Say, I think pump classes are very popular, which is light resistance, but essentially you're just doing loads and loads of intervals of resistance training. Now, the bonus there is that what you'll get is you'll get some muscle mass as well. So you've got that extra stimulus of it, because high intensity interval training tends to be quite high force. So you're either maintaining, or probably not for people who don't have a lot of muscle mass and aren't that well conditioned, you'll probably make a little bit of muscle mass gain. And that's really critical to increasing your resting metabolic rate. So there's another piece around why high intensity interval training can be quite effective, because you're also maintaining muscle mass, whereas people who tend to diet and have the yo-yo effect, they tend to diet really well and they're really disciplined, but what they're doing is losing muscle mass. And so when they then stop the diet, because no one maintains that intensity of discipline on a diet, they actually maybe eat the same calories or slightly more when they go back, and because they've got less muscle mass, they don't have as much of a resting metabolic rate, so they put all the weight on, if not more, again, and it's probably of a higher composition of fat, unfortunately.
Actually, and interestingly, I think, you know, I do a fair bit of HIIT training now because of, you know, you're a bit more time poor and everything else. But what is interesting is that I do a kind of class at a local gym, and there's definitely some people in there who do double sessions of it. So they'll do a sort of 45-minute class twice a day. That's too much, right?
I mean, each to their own. I would say, yes, that is too much. But I'd also challenge them to say, is it truly your maximal intensity? I would suggest that to be able to do that, because 45 minutes is a long time. Now, I would contend that they'll call it a high-intensity interval training session, but if you look at it, it's probably going to be you're probably going to be sitting into quite an aerobic level of work. So really good high-intensity interval training for me, it pushes you across those energy systems of anaerobic and aerobic. So it needs to be short. I mean, there's a very popular type of high-intensity interval training called Tabata training that came out of Japan, and the test was literally 20-second efforts with 10 seconds off on a bike, but it was at about 180% of your maximal power of VO2. Now, like, people have taken that and manipulated it and used it in the way they want. The key thing with that is the exercise modality. You have to be able to put out maximal intensity. So cycling is usually a good choice because it's not technically that hard. The other thing is, if you're doing it at maximal intensity, you're pretty much going to do the 4 minutes and that's it. People who say, oh, I'm doing Tabata intervals and they're doing 20, 30 minutes of it, I would contest, one, the modality is not going to allow them to be do it hard enough, and two, they're not actually going to maximal intensity. But yeah, so certainly 245 minutes of high intensity interval training, I think that would probably be, that wouldn't be able to sustain that for a long period of time.
So what you're saying, Mark, is these women in the gym who do about 12 sessions a week have hit are basically not training hard enough when they do it.
I don't, well,
that's what I'll tell myself.
It's maybe not their fault. Maybe the instructors need to sort of define what it actually is. It's probably good. It's probably, look, don't get me wrong, any activity for me is good activity. So yeah, if they're doing it, great. You're fitter, you're healthier. That's fantastic.
So our traditional forms of exercise. So if we go back, I certainly remember being in gyms maybe 20 plus years ago, and cardio was, you know, rife. People will be on a stepper or a bike or a treadmill for minutes on end. Is that still relevant today?
Certainly in the elite sporting world, in certain sports it is. And again, it depends on what the athletes need. But I think it really is, because the biggest thing for me is, yes, high intensity training is of huge benefit, but the motivational requirement to engage in that, you know, it's really hard. You know, it's going to be quite tough. You know, it's going to hurt. It is really, really challenging. And even when you see top athletes, they'll have blocks of training within their training year that are going to be really, really hard. But it's not continuously like that, and it's usually done to allow them, you know, there's a lot of work that goes on before those really high intensity blocks of training, which are to peak their skills and peak their physicality in the sporting domain. There's a lot of work that goes on before that to allow them to that opportunity to actually deliver that will then lead into hopefully successful competition. And I suppose with the general public, you know, my message is, look, you need to be consistent with your training. It's not about a flash in the pan 6 weeks of high intensity interval training and then doing nothing. But what are the options that you can engage in consistently that you really enjoy? Look, for some people, it might just be a brisk walk. It might just be an easy jog. You might do a block of high-intensity interval training and actually, I'm just going to do some nice cardio on a bike and stuff like that. You know, that's the sort of thing I think people need to think about is, what can I do? Yes, I might like doing high-intensity interval training, but what else can I do to maintain a consistent physical engagement to keep yourself fit and healthy?
And obviously everybody kind of loves a shortcut these days to getting fit and healthy. Are there any, and do they work?
Oh, in my opinion, no. I've looked at hundreds of different approaches that people are trying to sell. And actually, if you dig deep down into it, you're going to have to probably work hard, and you're probably going to have to commit to something and be really, really disciplined. Certainly a well-balanced program that has maybe some high-intensity interval training in it will get results fairly quickly, probably more than, you know, doing longer cardio stuff. But it's just balancing that out, because I just don't believe that people can engage in that intensity of work for that period of time. I tried some CrossFit training for a while, and it was just horrible. Like, you know, it's one of those, it's that feeling of euphoria once you've done a session. But my goodness, the dread of knowing what you've got to do to yourself in the next session is almost debilitating. It's almost like, oh God, I don't want to do it. But you push yourself through. But it was certainly something I couldn't keep going all year. So it amazes me how those athletes do that.
Is there any times where you might use some of the new, I call them fads, they're not necessarily fads, but those sorts of training forms with elite athletes? So would anybody you work with do a CrossFit sort of session, for example?
Yeah. But it's and this is the thing I think S&C coaches do well in general, particularly in the EISS, if there is a new fad, and sometimes athletes bring it to you, they'll say, oh, what about this? I want to try this, because they think it'll be great, or a friend show them and they think it might work for them. It's about making sure you're assessing actually what it is that's going to offer, how that's going to actually support what the athlete's trying to achieve physically, and obviously the coach alongside that. To some degree, it might be a psychological break from the monotony of what they actually have to do. But I think the one thing that we do really well in the EIS is actually understand what that might offer us. So it's not just about taking something because it's there. It's about, okay, what can this actually offer in our environment? A lot of times what you see is a general fad. There's probably been stuff that's actually probably been taken out of elite sport. So it's someone seeing something in elite sport and thinking, oh yeah, that'll be really good. I can package that up. I could sell that and make a bit of money. And so, you know, in elite sport, we sit there and go, oh yeah, we've done that. We use it in a different way because it's part of an overall training process. So you can't just throw, CrossFit as in a program, and that's all they do.
What's an example of one of those things? I remember kettlebells were called a new form of training, and kettlebells have been around probably 100 years. So
Yeah. I mean, Swiss balls as well. I think, you know, that they've been around for 50, 60 years. And that's the thing. It was like, again, someone's found something that was an effective sort of training regime back whenever, and they've just modernized it and brought it back to into the public limelight. But kettlebell, certainly, again, it's a tool. It's a tool that may offer different options for athletes, and it might even be a progression for a lot of athletes in our world. In the elite sporting environment, kettlebells probably aren't going to offer the stimulus and the overload that we need. So it might fit into a different part of their training, like a general preparation phase. I'm sure you went through a few of those, Goldie, where you just have to get yourself fit in all sorts of different ways to then allow you to do the training in your sport more often at a higher intensity, which then will improve your performance. So yeah, it's a balancing act. We certainly, you know, we have kettlebells in our gym, we have dumbbells, we have barbells, you know, but we apply it in a way that's measured and appropriate to get the output that we want from the athlete.
And I suppose with the advent of social media, you're getting, you know, a lot of different training forms kind of thrown at you as the next way to get fitter, healthier, stronger, whatever it may be. Is there anything you've seen that is particularly dangerous, for example?
Well, I think the danger is, you know, particularly in relation to what the public may see from elite athletes, is understanding the capability of the elite athlete. I mean, I saw a video recently of a Japanese high jumper, like world class. You're talking 2 meters 30, being able to jump over 2 meters 30, and he was dropping off boxes that literally looked like almost the first floor of the height of a first floor of a house, yeah. And he was landing stiff and then bouncing back off. Now, but there was no sort of qualifying information or information to actually describe who this was, and people went just absolutely ballistic on social media about, "Wow, you shouldn't be doing that, that's terrible," and then someone, another SSC expert who knew that the athlete was, just jumped and said, "This is a 2 meter 30 high jumper." That's my biggest fear, is that most forms of exercise are going to be pretty safe if they're applied appropriately, but when the general public see things like that and maybe think that looks like a good idea, you better be talking to an expert about whether you're applying that appropriately for what you're capable of doing. And I suppose we talked about it earlier, that elite athletes, like you say, Goldie, are going to put out what they're good at. It's actually surprising when you take elite athletes into other domains of physical output that isn't part of what they do. There's people in the public that would kill, that would be much, much better than them. And sometimes the general public don't understand that. They think, "Oh, surely you're an elite athlete. You're a great squash player. You're a great boxer. You're a great sprinter. You must be able to do this." Ask a sprinter to try and run a half marathon, they'll be looking at you going, "No."
Yeah, no, I can completely concur to that. The first time I went to a park run, just a 5K, as a recently retired javelin thrower, I was absolutely petrified. And I was with some mates who obviously knew that I was an Olympian, and they were like, "Well, you're an Olympic athlete, this is easy for you." And I was like, "I'm not even sure I can get round," because the furthest I would run towards the end of my career certainly was probably running 60 meters, but it's flat out sprinting. I mean, I could run the 30 meters in 4 seconds, but, you know, put me in a 5K. I remember I was at a dinner with our best marathon runner at the time, a girl called Steph Twell, and I said what my park run time was, and she was absolutely horrified. so yeah, with definitely there's a specificity, certainly for sport, that's for
sure. Very much so, very much so, yeah.
But it's getting better, I can tell you that now, thankfully. So, tips for people listening who want to get fitter, and that's quite a global term, isn't it? But if you had a week and you were training somebody who perhaps had an office job, what would you do with them in a week to give them the best hope of getting fitter and more healthy and just feeling good in their bodies?
I've talked about the approach that we take with sports. I'd probably take that same sort of approach with an individual. It's like, what do you like doing? You know, but then I'd also challenge them to include things that I think are really, really beneficial. And so flexibility and mobility, probably fundamentally to me, are probably two of the most important things. And then strength. The analogy I make is, like, when we get older, it's all well and good if you've got a fantastic heart and lungs, but if you can't get out of your chair, it's not going to be of much use to you, is it? And so those two things, flexibility, mobility and strength, are the things that are going to allow us to move well for the majority of our life. And it actually staves off a lot of the aging process as well. But in a week, if I can get someone to understand that and put that in place and show them how it can be done really, really simply within their training that they do, that'd be great. But then just get to know who they are and what they like, and then try and show them some different options. And yes, cardiovascular is important, but if they think they might want to try some HIIT as well, we can throw some of that in as well. But then really just try and deliver the message that it's not about a one-off week or a six-week program of doing something. It's about making sure you've got physical activity as part of your lifestyle. But that doesn't necessarily mean it needs to be peak physical activity all the time. As you know, Goldie, elite athletes take time off. But what we try to encourage our athletes to do as S&C coaches, if you're going to take a break, still make it active, still keep the body moving, so then you come back not starting from scratch again. It's never starting from scratch, but the more you can stave off detraining and losing fitness, the better place we're going to start at, and then we can elevate you to a high level. And it's the same for most people in the general public as well.
So you talked there about flexibility and mobility. Is that yoga to an everyday person, or would it be, obviously there's other ways of being flexible? Obviously there is just stretching too, but what else could you do? But and do you like yoga as a practice?
I do, yeah. So for the general public, definitely. And like, yoga's probably taken some hits over the years, as far as, like, you know, I've engaged in a lot of yoga over my life, and it's certainly something. I worked in diving for a long period of time as well, and obviously being a gymnastic type sport, there's huge need for pretty extreme ranges of motion. So having that knowledge, maybe not so much around yoga, but around flexibility, mobility solutions, was really, really important. But yeah, yoga is definitely a great thing. Some people may not like the whole om and the meditation piece, but there's ways you can engage in it without that, just to make sure that, again, you're trying to get the body to move well. There's loads of different stretch classes and things out there. And actually, if you go on social media, the amount of information around flexibility and mobility is really, really high. Sometimes it might be hard to sift through to find the good stuff, but there is some, like, I've looked at a lot of things and there's some really, really good stuff out there.
So what would a diver do flexibility wise?
Essentially, divers are just gymnasts that jump into, well, sort of dive into water. So, you know, when you the gymnastics sort of discipline that it is, the gymnastics elements, you know, they'll be stretching pretty much every day, but they'll be stretching in a specific way to attain the shapes that they need to in the sport. So obviously they spin very fast when they tuck, they have to do pike shape, and that's part of the discipline of the sport that allows them to score really highly and hopefully, like Tom Daly, win a gold medal in the Olympics. Yeah. That sort of flexibility where there's an extreme range of motion required to be able to achieve it, or when athletes get a bit older, maintain it because they've achieved it at a young age, it takes pretty much a stimulus that's going to be daily.
And you talked there also about detraining, which is quite a fascinating subject. And I certainly know quite a few athletes who think, or certainly in the earlier days of their career, if they think, oh, if I take time off, then I'm going to lose so much fitness. I'm thinking a lot of endurance athletes when I say that. How long does it take to detrain, and what does actually detraining mean? So can you lose your fit? Can you lose all your fitness? Is that even possible?
You certainly could. If you sat on the couch for years and years on end and you had attained a certain level of fitness across all sort of physical characteristics, then yes, you can definitely lose it all. The detraining is just a process where the body loses the ability to put a physical output out. In the simplest terms, aerobic fitness tends to drop fairly quickly. Strength is fairly robust if it's been well established. So strong people tend to be strong. They might not be at their very peak level, but the big strongman fellows, I can guarantee that after a year of not training, they're probably still going to be able to lift a car. Yeah, but if a marathon runner takes a long period of time off, they're probably not going to be able to get very close to their sort of peak levels of speed and performance. But again, it can be the really interesting thing with the detraining, or maybe not detraining, is that it can be maintained really, really easily without as much volume. You get to a peak level of fitness, you may not be able to maintain that very, very peak because there's an incredibly challenging process that goes along with it, as I'm sure you know, trying to get that javelin out as far as you can. But you'll be able to keep 80, 85, 90% of that fitness quite comfortably with just, again, some consistent input into those physical characteristics.
But how long is too long off for an elite athlete?
For an elite athlete? If for me, if it's complete time off, I would say you probably wouldn't want, you wouldn't want more than 2 weeks. That's a very, very general sort of time period there. But, you know, I think after that period of time, you need to start getting back into something that's going to maintain that those physical qualities or start to build them back up.
So what you're saying is balance is key. Yes. In strength conditioning, certainly for somebody who isn't an elite athlete. So cardio isn't necessarily dead, but there are other forms of training, and HIIT training is okay, potentially in moderation.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's exactly it. Everything in moderation, really, which is probably something that I think a lot of people need to live by in all aspects of sort of their looking after their body. Obviously, it's probably the key thing with the diet as well, isn't it? But no, cardio is not dead in my eyes at all. It plays a huge role in supporting the preparation of some athletes. And it depends on what type of cardio. For some, it's long duration cardio. For some, it's maybe shorter.
Okay. And if you only had one kind of training modality that you could use for the rest of your life, what would you do?
Oh,
and why?
Gosh, that's a really good
curveball.
One training modality for myself personally, I'd be strength training. You maintain your muscle mass, so that's going to keep my resting metabolic rate higher so I can stay in better shape. So hopefully I can still eat the nice stuff that I like to eat. Two, it means that I'll be able to move better for longer for my entire life, so I can try and keep up with my 6-year-old who had her birthday today and my 3-year-old, keep up with them for longer as I get older.
And you can squat down and pick them up as
exactly. And you know, when we talk about things, and squat's a great example, Goldie, when we talk about squats, a squat done well to good depth with really good control and good form with weight or without weight is a great mobility exercise. So the benefits of moving well through what we traditionally call strength exercises like squats or lunges, you know, press-ups, pull-ups and all that sort of stuff, it just offers so much as far as capability to move.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for joining us today, Mark, and enjoy squatting for the rest of the week.
Thanks very much, Goldie. It's been a pleasure.
If you've liked what you heard so far this series, then please give the EIS Insider a follow wherever you get your podcasts. And whilst you're there, why not leave a review? It helps other listeners to find our show. You can get in touch with us on social media at EIS2Win. And don't forget to check out our website and YouTube channel for more great content from the English Institute of Sport. Next time on the EIS Insider, we'll be learning how to think like a champion as we delve into the world of sports psychology. That's on the way in the next episode of the EIS Insider. We'll talk soon.